This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's unclear what chemical and biological weapons Iraq has today and what weapons Iraq has made or might make available to terrorist groups. But we do know that Saddam Hussein has already launched chemical attacks in Iraq, although most of us know very little about what happened. In the early 90s, Human Rights Watch published a report titled Iraq's Crime of Genocide, which estimated that between 50 and 100,000 people were killed in chemical attacks launched by Saddam's regime against as many as 200 Iraqi villages and towns. My guest journalist Jeffrey Goldberg has written about the chemical attack on the city of Halabja in northern Iraq on March 16, 1988. Halabja was then home to about 80,000 Kurds, many of whom opposed Saddam's regime. Goldberg traveled to Halabja, interviewed survivors and doctors, and published his report in last week's New Yorker. He's a staff writer for the magazine and covers the Middle East. One of the survivors he spoke with, named Nasreen, was in her basement at the time of the attack, taking shelter from bombs. I asked Goldberg what Nasreen saw when she emerged.
She was the first one in her family, as best as I can tell, to notice that something was awry. There was something different about March 16th. She had been in the kitchen cooking with her sister for the 30 or 40 relatives who were in her basement, and she saw a helicopter come by with photographers in it, taking pictures of Halabja, an army helicopter, and she thought that was very strange. She went into the basement when the artillery bombardment occurred. You have to understand something here that's so diabolically clever. The Iraqis, knowing that gas is heavier than air and would penetrate cellars and basements more effectively, drove everybody into the basements by launching a conventional artillery attack on the town for several hours. In other words, they knew that people would do what they always did during an artillery barrage and run to their basements. They were stuck in their basements, and then they launched the chemical weapons attack, which this, of course, made the chemical weapons attack very effective because the gas started seeping into the basements and the cellars, turning them really, I mean, the way it was described to me really is as gas chambers, in essence. Nasreen came out. She saw that her family partridge, a bird in a cage, was dying. She saw some of the farm animals dying, and she went downstairs to her family, and a lot of the people in the basement were getting sick rather quickly. The children were vomiting. The old people were vomiting. Their eyes were becoming extremely red, and they had to make this awful decision: stay in the basement, which was what they had been conditioned to do during an attack, or go out on the street and run and risk being exposed. Eventually, they decided to get out. They started making their way out of town. A lot of the small children, Nasreen was only 16 at the time, but she was married already, but a lot of the small children, cousins and nephews and extended family, couldn't walk any longer, so they had to be carried. And what happened in this exodus from the town, they were trying to get to the hills, obviously, what happened in this exodus was that people just would fall along the roads, along the roadsides. They would just fall and collapse. The mustard gas in particular was burning out their lungs and creating conditions in which they couldn't breathe.
So after Nasreen and her families decided to run for the hills, they managed to jump on a truck.
Right.
A truck that was carrying the dying and the dead.
Right.
And
right.
How far did they get on the truck?
Well, they didn't get very far because the driver was blinded. People in this town lost their vision in a matter of minutes and sometimes, certainly over several hours. He was blinded. His own family was in this truck, and he basically said he got out of the truck blind and sort of yelled at everybody, you know, get out if you can, but I can't go on. And he wandered away. And Nasreen, it's interesting, 14 years after the fact, still sort of apologizes for his behavior, and it's her belief that possibly some of the nerve agents that were used affected his mental capacity, affected his ability to think clearly. And that's the way she explains his decision, if you will, to abandon his family. The people who still could see led the people who couldn't up a little bit into the hills, where they found a mosque that was empty, and then they found a house next to a mosque. They went to the house, and people started dying there. They were looking for food, of course. The food was probably contaminated by that point. The children were screaming, that their eyes were bleeding, that they couldn't see, that they were all blinded. And then at a certain point in that long, dark night, Nasreen herself went blind. And It was only because her husband, a man named Bakhtiar, who was outside the village, outside the town at the time, managed to find her that I think they survived. He had his vision, and he wasn't directly affected by the chemicals. And so he organized them and washed them up and tried to give medicine to those he could. And I think that's why they survived.
Her husband had managed to get two syringes of a medication, atropine, that's supposed to counter the effects of chemical attacks. How did he get them, and who did he decide to use those two syringes on?
This was not the first chemical attacks in Kurdistan, so people knew a little bit about what to do. He was a physician's assistant, so he had some training in this. And the Kurdish guerrillas who were fighting the Iraqi regime had managed to gather up some syringes of atropine. He had a couple that he got from a clinic, and he injected himself. This is before he found Nusrin. He injected himself, a wise decision. Obviously, it meant that he could function and help people. He had one more, and he was faced with this, I don't want to invoke this too lightly, but kind of a Sophie's choice, if you will. When he found the 20 or 30 people who were with Nusrin in the house up on the hill, many throwing up, many blinded, many obviously suffering, he had a choice. He could have injected Nusrin, but he didn't. He found the person who seemed to be suffering the most, a woman named Azmi, who, as they described it, was experiencing kind of a psychological breakdown or mental breakdown caused either by reality, the events that she was seeing, or by the actual workings of nerve agents on her brain. She was slamming herself into walls and doing all kinds of very destructive things. So he chose to use this one syringe of atropine on her, but she died anyway. And I think to this day he still questions his decision not to inject his own wife with this one syringe of atropine that he had. And it's fascinating to watch the dynamic between the two of them, because she has forgiven him completely for his decision to help the most seriously injured person.
What were the long-term effects of the chemical attack on Nusrin?
She was blind for 20 days. They were eventually taken to Iran, to hospitals in Iran. She was blind for 20 days. She had some burning, some mustard gas-related burning on her skin. But the most insidious, terrible effect on Nusrin was the following. She was in the hospital. And yeah, let me preface this by saying that Kurdish society is quite conservative. It's a Muslim society. And she said that she noticed and told her doctors very quietly that she began to menstruate soon after she got to the hospital in Iran. And it didn't stop after a few days. It just kept going. She was horrified by this. She found out through quiet conversation with some of the other women that they too were menstruating and couldn't stop. Eventually they told the doctors, and the doctors prescribed the medicine to help stop this bleeding. But the doctors told her at the same time that she would be infertile, that she could not bear children. She didn't believe them. She chose not to believe them. And 2 years later, back in Kurdistan already, this is after the Gulf War, she conceived and she delivered a baby boy. And Bakhtiar and Nusrin named the baby boy the Kurdish word for hope. What happened was that the baby had a hole in his heart, and he died after 3 months. And that was the last time she became pregnant. And that's her story. And this is a story that's replicated across Kurdistan. Various problems with congenital malformations of babies conceived after the attacks. Obviously, and if you broaden it out, the problems range from colon cancer, skin cancers, lung cancer, liver cancer, to cleft palates and hair lips and strange tumors growing on people's backs. Obviously, the long-term effects on the lungs of mustard gas are lung scarring and diminished capacity to breathe. A lot of these people need lung transplants, which, of course, they can't get in Kurdistan. The effects are never-ending. I could go on all day about them, but I think that gives you a snapshot of what's happening there.
My guest is journalist Jeffrey Goldberg. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Jeffrey Goldberg, and in a recent edition of The New Yorker, He reported on the short and long-term effects of the Saddam Hussein administration's chemical attacks on Kurdistan in 1988. Part of your article is devoted to the story of Nasreen and what she saw and experienced on the day of the attacks. How did you meet Nasreen?
When I got to Kurdistan, the Kurds who were running their own self-government, their own administration, if you will, in the north of Iraq, are obviously quite keen to get their story out to the world. They don't get a lot of journalists visiting them. So when I told various Kurdish officials what I was interested in doing, namely meeting victims of the chemical weapons attacks, they organized for me very efficiently different groups in different cities of people who had been attacked in this town or that town. These meetings are very difficult. Obviously, it's very difficult for a journalist to focus, if you will, on seven different stories coming at him at once. It's also very difficult to keep your own humanity and express the sympathy that you feel when there's so many people and you're so inundated with these terrible stories. Something about Nasreen stood out, though. It was the sort of the biblical-sized calamity that occurred to her family. She lost five siblings in this attack, as well as her mother, and her father was permanently blinded. She was also a very composed, very eloquent woman, and obviously very frank, telling me about her problems with menstruation. I mean, here I am, an American male journalist she had never met before, and she was willing to talk about these things.
Now, you interviewed several other people who survived the chemical attack in Halabja.
Yes. Yeah.
Were their stories similar to Nasreen's?
Yes. What's interesting is that families, extended families, huddled together during these attacks. So those families who were in cellars which were affected, those families were wiped out. It's really astonishing, actually, to meet some people in Halabja who did not have a single person in their family die, and then to meet others who tell you very matter-of-factly, and also hand you lists of 120 relatives they lost, or 80 relatives that they lost in one day. It all had to do with where the chemicals were dropped, and so you do hear stories also, by the way, of families that were completely wiped out. I visited a woman in a house that was attacked. She's a new owner of the house, and she said, as far as she knows, every single member of the extended family that was in this house during the attack died.
Now, you've mentioned that there were many long-term health effects of the chemical attacks.
Right,
cancers of all sorts and other, you know, lung problems. One of the odd long-term effects that you mentioned is that snakes became more toxic.
Well, this is a very interesting point. I heard this from many Kurdish doctors. And they said this in terms of, be careful, because the snakes in Halabja are very numerous and aggressive. I didn't see any snakes, but I started asking around about this, and they said, well, yes, what happened was, we don't know what happened. We don't know more than we know about a whole range of issues. This is one of them. We think that in the chemical attacks, a particular kind of bird that eats snakes was wiped out. The snakes were not affected. Therefore, they reproduced at a much greater pace and therefore became much more numerous. There are also physicians who say they believe that the bites, that the venom of these snakes is more toxic now due to a mutation caused by the chemical weapons. I talked to a number of Western experts on this, and they said this could have a couple of explanations. One is that this could be sort of a mass psychosis, if you will, that the people having been afflicted with this biblically sized plague believe all kinds of terrible things about their environment that aren't true. Another possible explanation is that it is true that the environmental imbalances caused by the wiping out of various bird species in that immediate area did lead to a great number of snakes being born and not being eaten by birds. They said that it's probably not true that the snakes had actually mutated into something more deadly. But this brings me to a point that's incredibly important to make, which is that this chemical weapons attack on Halabja and the chemical weapons attacks on nearly 200 other villages and towns have never been studied by Western scientists. We don't know what happened in Halabja to any point of precision. We don't even know for sure what chemical agents were used. We have our suspicions. American scientists have their suspicions.
We'll get to that in a second. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this issue of the snakes is one manifestation of this lack of knowledge about what really happened there.
How long did it take until the site of the attacks was no longer toxic?
It might still be toxic. We don't know that it's not toxic. Nothing's been decontaminated. I mean, I had this moment when I was standing in one of these basements where, I was told 100 people had died. And I turned to one of the doctors who was accompanying me, and I said, is this place been decontaminated? It just struck me all of a sudden. And he said, nothing in Kurdistan has ever been decontaminated. It's amazing to think about the decontamination process that's going on in the Brentwood Postal Facility in Washington, D.C., or one of the Senate office buildings after the anthrax attacks. Nothing like that has ever taken place. Scientists believe that the half-lives of nerve agents are very short. Mustard gas can linger in the environment. Again, the problem is we do not understand fully the range of weapons used on the Kurds and on the water and food supply of Kurdistan. So as far as these people are concerned, they're living in contaminated areas. It's kind of like going back to Chernobyl and living there.
What do experts now think was in the brew that Saddam Hussein used in the chemical attack on Halabja?
They believe with a reasonable degree of certainty that it was mustard gas in combination with three nerve agents, VX, sarin, and tabun. There are suspicions, and these are suspicions that are held by Kurdish doctors as well as some people in the West, that Saddam mixed in this brew a biological agent called aflatoxin. There's no proof that it was used, but there's, of course, no proof that it wasn't because no one has ever studied this. Aflatoxin is a mycotoxin. It's a mold that grows on grain, and it's in weaponized form, it can only do one thing, which is cause long-term liver cancer, particularly in children. The Kurdish doctors see elevated rates of liver cancer in children, and they've sort of walked this backwards, if you will, and are questioning whether aflatoxin was also used. But we don't know. We simply don't know.
Now, you've been wondering if al-Qaeda or other Islamic extremist groups might get toxic weapons from Iraq. Are there any connections you've been able to find between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda?
When I was in Kurdistan, I started to do some research about a terrorist group operating in one corner of the area. It's called the Ansar al-Islam, which means supporters of Islam. It was formerly known as the Jund al-Islam, the soldiers of Islam. This group is al-Qaeda influenced, if you will. Its ideology is very similar. And many of its leaders, according to the people I spoke to, are quote-unquote Afghan Arabs, people who cycled through Afghanistan either to fight the Soviets or to train in the camps of al-Qaeda. So there is very little doubt that this group is linked to al-Qaeda in some serious way. What I found, or what I heard, I should say, were allegations from credible people who said that, in fact, this group is co-sponsored. It's not under the sole sponsorship of al-Qaeda. It's co-sponsored, the other sponsor being Saddam's intelligence service. This makes sense. This has the benefit of making sense. Saddam and al-Qaeda have an interest in destabilizing the Kurdish free zone, if you will, the area of Iraq that's under the protection of the American Air Force in the no-fly zone. So it would make sense that they would work together on this project. And of course, Saddam's intelligence agents and al-Qaeda operatives do share a hatred of America and a hatred of America's allies, who include most definitively the Kurds, the Kurdish leadership in Kurdistan. So I guess I'm left with this feeling. When I was there, I asked my Kurdish sources on this subject why they were giving me so much information on this, and they said, well, we really want you to go back to Washington and tell the CIA that we have all this information about al-Qaeda and its links to Saddam, because we think that this is useful information. Which of course raised the question, you mean the CIA hasn't been here? And they said no, and we're trying to get them interested. The only conclusion I would draw definitively from these encounters is that this is an area worthy of further American exploration. This would be an interesting place for American intelligence agents, officers, to go and explore. And that's what I came away with.
Of course, the people you were speaking to wouldn't necessarily know if the CIA had been there.
No, the people I was speaking to would know. I'm talking about the head of the Kurdish intelligence agency.
Oh, yes, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Yeah. I mean, he could be not telling me the truth. I was just, after several days with these people, I felt that they were more earnest than manipulative.
Mm-hmm.
And that their desire was really, you know, could you please let them know what's going on over here and have them come out? And, you know, I was open to the idea that I was being used by the Kurds, but after several days of exploring this, I decided, no, you know, there really might be something here, and it really might be something useful for American intelligence service to actually go and explore.
Jeffrey Goldberg is a staff writer for The New Yorker. He covers the Middle East. His article, The Great Terror, was published in the March 25th edition of the magazine. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jeffrey Goldberg, a staff writer for The New Yorker who covers the Middle East. In the March 25th edition, he reported on Saddam Hussein's 1988 chemical attack on the Kurds in the northern Iraqi town of Halabja. Goldberg pieced together what happened, based on eyewitness accounts, and wrote about the short and long-term effects of the chemical attack. During the period of the Gulf War, Saddam Hussein was described as having a comparatively secular regime. You say that about 10 years ago he underwent something of a battlefield conversion to a fundamentalist brand of Islam. Do you know what happened?
Well, I can say with reasonable surety that it was not heartfelt. You know, Saddam's an interesting character. He's a pan-Arabist secularist when that's useful. But he also speaks in the language of Islamic fundamentalism when that's useful. I'm not saying that he's a religious person now, God knows. But I think what occurred was he decided that he could link up his cause, his anti-American cause, if you will, with the Islamic fundamentalists who were also developing these anti-American feelings. And that is why it's credible that Saddam and al-Qaeda might be working together. On the face of it, it seems illogical. Saddam is a secularist on paper, and al-Qaeda is obviously, you know, a religiously fundamentalist movement. But they share interests, and so it's not inconceivable.
You say that Saddam Hussein is now a prime supporter of the Palestinian anti-Israeli groups Islamic Jihad and Hamas. Is that common knowledge, or is that something that you found out?
It's certainly common knowledge in the community of people who pay obsessive attention to these sorts of issues. When people look at the supporters of Islamic Jihad and Hamas, they look more to Iran than Iraq. But Saddam Hussein is doing something very interesting. He is, and this has been documented, he is paying the families of suicide bombers a lump sum of $10,000, which of course is an extraordinary amount of money in the West Bank or the Gaza Strip. So he's buying his way into the conflict, if you will, through these large cash grants to suicide bombers. Of course, these kind of cash grants encourage other people to become suicide bombers because they know that their families will be taken care of by Saddam Hussein when and if they blow themselves up in standing in the middle of a crowd of Israeli civilians.
You say that Israel and the Jews are now Saddam Hussein's main preoccupation. Why is that?
Yeah. An interesting scholar named Amatzia Baram, who's from Haifa University, who knows more about Saddam Hussein's family than anybody I've ever met. He reads everything coming out of Iraq. Explained it this way, and this was echoed, by the way, by Iraqi Muslims, dissidents I spoke to. He says this: Saddam wants to be remembered 1,000 years from now. He wants his legacy to be taught to fourth graders in every Arab country 1,000 years from now. He can't do that by killing Kurds. That's not the main game in the Middle East. He can only ensure immortality, if you will, by bringing Israel to its knees. That is the struggle That is the main field of battle between Arabs and the West, if you will. And so he's a very historically minded figure from everything that I've read and from everyone I've talked to. He frequently compares himself to Hammurabi, to Nebuchadnezzar, to Saladin, and he's looking for a way. Amatzia Baram put it this way. He said he's looking for a way to absolve himself of the sins he's committed against Arabs and against Muslims over the past 20 years. And here's the thing. I think there's some logic to this. If he brought Israel to its knees in some manner, through a biological weapons attack, say, he would be known as the one Arab who actually brought about the destruction or the permanent weakening of Israel. And it's quite a fascinating point. And that's why American military planners, Israeli military planners, Iraqi dissidents, the Kurds themselves will actually say this. They all believe that when push comes to shove, Saddam will save his missiles for an attack on Israel, not on Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or the Kurds.
If there's a connection between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, then al-Qaeda could conceivably get chemical weapons from Iraq. I'm wondering if al-Qaeda would need Iraq for chemical weapons. How difficult are these chemical weapons to make?
Well, I'm convinced that that's the actual short-term danger. There's a famous Iraqi dissident named Kanan Makia I spoke to for this story, and he says this is the scenario. Iraq is the address. Iraq is a state everyone in the world knows builds chemical and biological weapons. If you're a terrorist who needs biological and chemical weapons, that's the address. Right now, of course, with all the focus on al-Qaeda and all the focus on Iraq, it's very difficult, presumably, to make such an arrangement. But Kanan Makia's argument and the argument of others is that if Saddam is allowed to stay in power over the next couple of years, 3 or 4 years, our interest will wane. If he plays this smart, he'll be very quiet. And then terrorist groups will look to him as the pharmacy, if you will. They'll go to him and go to Iraq for these weapons. And I think it's extraordinarily important when you have an actual state apparatus behind your chemical weapons programs. It's not so easy, I would imagine, for an al-Qaeda operative sitting in Hamburg, Germany, to create a weapons laboratory. It turns out, you know, as we're seeing, you know, hints of this from Afghanistan, that there was a development program in Afghanistan developed by al-Qaeda to create these kind of weapons. That sanctuary has now been denied to al-Qaeda by the American military, but Iraq still exists as an independent state, and an independent state sponsor of these programs is obviously a great threat.
The Bush administration is trying to line up support internationally for attacking Iraq and going after its chemical and nuclear capabilities. Do you feel that your article in The New Yorker adds weight to the Bush administration's argument that some action against Iraq needs to be taken?
Well, I can't deny the obvious. The vice president and the president have both invoked my article as proof of Saddam's nefariousness, if you will. I'm going to let my article speak for itself. As I said, I started working on this 2 years ago. And let me say this. If I had an agenda, it would be to get medical attention for the Kurds who suffered through these attacks. I'm a reporter. I'm not a pundit. I try to go to places and gather information. If the information adds up to a certain conclusion, well, then the information adds up to a certain conclusion. But I'm uncomfortable, obviously, being a pundit on this subject. You know, am I glad that people are talking about my article? Of course. I mean, the worst thing in the world is to have people ignore it. And if people draw certain conclusions about the nature of the regime, well, then they're going to draw those conclusions.
Well, Jeffrey Goldberg, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Goldberg's article, The Great Terror, was published in the March 25th edition of The New Yorker. This is Fresh Air.